Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm very pleased to have Eric McCullough, who is the producer of, and director of Brzezinski, the movie. This is a remarkable movie outlining the story of a cancer researcher and doctor who actively treats patients, who is a developer of anti-neoplastins. I have heard for years about the effectiveness of these treatments, especially in brain tumors and especially in untreatable childhood brain tumors of the brainstem, and his results are no less short of miraculous. However, Eric tells the story of what happened to him in a country that will, in this country, which is a remarkable story and one that we need to spread as far as we can so that we can get this pattern and practice change and get some true cancer research going on in this country. Welcome, Eric. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Can you give our listeners a little bit of background on how you first learned of the problem that the doctor was having and how you made the decision to make this more public and put together this movie?
Sure. I come from a pretty mainstream commercial background. I've worked on Madison Avenue for a long time in ad agencies, and I even worked on campaigns for the pharmaceutical industry as well. And I've always just sort of been interested in television and film and worked on TV shows and other movies, but never directed my own film before. And documentaries are something that I think are really important, especially in this day and age. It's almost like the documentary filmmaker world is sort of picking up, or the mainstream media sort of scared or won't take the effort to go into. So it's almost like an extension of journalism, really. So basically, I read a book by a man named Ralph Moss, who worked at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and he was the public relations director, and he was fired because he blew the whistle on a cover-up for another cancer treatment that was going on and being studied there. They were getting good results behind the scenes, and they Ralph's job was to tell the world that they were getting bad results. So he so he blew the whistle and he got fired, and he got really interested in the subject, and he wrote a book called The Cancer Industry. And in that book, there's a chapter on Dr. Brzezinski. And what stuck out to me about Brzezinski was, unlike a lot of the other treatments out there that most people know about, they're usually sort of suppressed and ignored because of non-patentability. And in this case, it's a little different. It's a genuine scientific discovery that Brzezinski had made, one that had never been discovered before, and he managed to learn how to synthesize this discovery and have patents on it. He's in FDA-approved clinical trials, and he's done it independently without the help of government funding or the help of the pharmaceutical industry itself. And so that just fascinated me. And then on top of the fact that he is, curing incurable cancer, so you combine the two, I couldn't really sort of forget about that. So I just started emailing and calling the clinic, and essentially it took like 6 months of back and forth with them, and just to really gain their trust. And
their trust, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure they've had a lot of other instances where it was untrustworthy. So
yeah,
that was
I'd just come off the tail end of another journalist who came in with big open arms. He writes for the Houston Press and was very friendly, and they gave him everything he needed to know. And, of course, the article was just completely bashing him, and it was a big bad hatchet job.
Right.
You know, that was like a month before I started calling them.
Didn't help. Well, these people are sending on purpose, as you know.
Sure.
It's not something that is there is two kinds of media in this country, as I don't need to tell you, the true free media and the media that represents the powers that be.
Right.
And it's very interesting. And I agree with you. Documentaries are absolutely crucial because none of these issues are simple. They're not to understand what he has been through and what he's been doing takes a documentary. It's even difficult just to do that in an article.
Sure. Yeah, it was hard to, there's a lot that happened that I was not able to fit in the film. The film is pretty lengthy and intense as it is.
Right. So,
yeah.
Well, let's go back and tell his story a little bit. I guess the story you tell in the documentary, and then we'll talk more in large about why and how cancer therapies are suppressed. And it's not just in the U.S. It's actually worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hammer in Europe was jailed when he had a high cure rate.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that when people start curing cancer right and left, often government agencies show up and engage them in ways to keep them from publishing or widely disseminating the information.
Right.
So this is pattern and practice type thing we can talk about later. But let's get back to him, if you can give a little bit of his story. And,
sure.
That'd be great.
Essentially, yeah, because they tried the same thing with him. They tried to throw him in prison as well, and he beat them in two federal trials. But I'll go back to the sort of the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
After he graduated first in his class from medical school, and while he was completing his PhD in biochemistry, he just miraculously found a strain of peptides in human blood, and also found them in human urine that had never mm-hmm. been recorded before. Really had no idea what it meant, but of course he, like any diligent scientist would, he followed mm-hmm. through on it. And as he kept testing these peptide levels in different people and different races and sexes and what have you, he found out that people with cancer seem to have a really low count of these peptides, or in some cases mm-hmm. are almost completely lacking them. So he just sort of hypothesized, wow, maybe if I can find out how to extract these peptides from healthy donors, mm-hmm. from their plasma or their urine, and give it to people with cancer, maybe it would be helpful. That's all,
right.
He sort of was going on.
Very simple.
yeah, right. and right around this time, the Communist Party was putting a lot of pressure on him to join the Communist Party in Poland, and because he was such a successful when he was first in his class and the peptide discovery, all this stuff sort of made headlines in
mm-hmm.
Poland. And he refused. He did not want to be a part of that. And they kept
mm-hmm.
Drafting him into the military over and over again as sort
oh,
of
no.
punishment. Yeah. And by the second time he was drafted, he realized he was surrounded by other scientists who were in the same boat as him.
Right. Great.
yeah. So, ironically, he flees Poland to escape escape tyranny, to come to the
mm-hmm.
land of the free, to, of course, face something so much worse. But, yeah, so he came with $20 in his pocket and his briefcase with his peptide studies.
Goodness.
Yeah. He goes to the Bronx, lives with his uncle, spent half his money on cab fare to get to the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
and quickly got a job at Baylor College in Texas teaching
mm-hmm.
medicine. And then also, because they also realized his peptide discovery, they were giving him a lot of free time to study this. And he even managed
mm-hmm.
to get money from our very own National Cancer Institute at this time.
Really?
Yeah, grant money to study the peptide. So then once they realized quickly how successful it was, that the NCI and Baylor College sort of wanted to bring him in the fray and bring him into the sort of establishment
mm-hmm.
to further it. However, he was going to lose control over it, and he
mm-hmm.
would just basically be an employee working on his discovery.
Right.
And that wasn't something he was willing to risk, because anything could have happened. They could have changed it, weakened it, shelved it, and any number of things.
He must have an incredible character to have gone through all of this and remain so strong. That's the thing I kept thinking. My goodness.
Right. And it's funny. I get that question in a lot of the Q&A.
Yeah.
What I found is he sort of realizes, which I think is a very important thing to realize, is that he knows that every scientific discovery throughout humanity that has been a paradigm-shifting scientific discovery
mm-hmm.
has been met with gigantic resistance. And he just knows that. And he knows that
yeah.
he just happens to be one of those guys that
right.
Is one of those, made one of those discoveries, and he's aware of that, and he's,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't let it sort of get to him too badly, because he understands this is just the fight he has
just
to fight.
It's the reality, exactly.
And a good example is, you look
mm-hmm.
at some of the things that Louis Pasteur discovered, and
mm-hmm.
and in his time, there wasn't this multi-trillion dollar sort of a cartel running
mm-hmm.
this industry. It was very free and open back then, somewhat. And so it was easy to introduce it into the public, versus today you have all this bureaucratic red tape to introduce
right.
anything into the public. So you have a double challenge. You have breaking the scientific sort of religious belief systems and allowing people to realize this is a
mm-hmm.
reality, and then you have the industry that has a lot to lose from allowing your discovery to move forward.
Right.
So once he, what's really exciting is that he got one lucky break essentially after another. Once he realized that even the establishment recognized that it worked, he said, okay, I want to figure out how to treat cancer patients without getting in
mm-hmm.
any sort of trouble and without
right.
dealing. And he also, he tried to apply for clinical trials through the Food and Drug
mm-hmm.
Administration, repeatedly was denied permission to do so. So
right.
he hired a legal team, And they look through, in the Texas law, they look through the law and realize that Texas sort of being, at least at the time, the law has since been changed, but being the renegade state that it sort of always has been, based on Texas law, if you are an individual scientist with your own individual discovery, treating your own patients in your own clinic, especially in the case of patients that have exhausted all other mainstream treatments and there's simply nothing else that can be done, and as long as you can do that, as long as your medicine doesn't leave the state of Texas, and then if it does do that, it gets into federal territory, and he would be breaking federal law.
Right.
So just a wonderful lucky break. And he even alerted the federal government and the state government, everything by the book, said, this is what I'm going to be doing, guys.
Right.
And they all just said, okay, what can we do? Because there's simply no law saying you can't do it. So he got his first cure in 1977, that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is someone that, he cured many more around this time, but every one of these people, you have to imagine that they exhausted everything. They were at death's door. And Brzezinski was, no one knew who he was. And think about the sort of risk they must have been taking or the sort of state of disparity they must have been in to go to some Polish guy they'd never heard of, just be treated by cancer, and then be cured. And so as soon as that started happening is when the resistance really began.
Right.
And at the same time, he became more and more popular. In 1983, he was on Sally Jesse Raphael's talk show with his patients. In 1986, Oprah's first year on the air, he was on her show with patients.
Mm-hmm.
And as he got more popular, the resistance kept pushing. So on the state level, they went in and tried to take away his license under the idea that he's practicing quackery and it doesn't work. And he showed that it worked. He jumped through every hoop they asked him to do, and they still ignored the positive results. They ignored petitions, like 60 petitions from patients saying, please leave my doctor alone. They ignored all of that, took him to trial numerous times, went all the way to the state Supreme Court, and he still came out clean. They even had one of the founders of the neuroradiology section of the National Cancer Institute, who focuses only on brain cancer, and for our own National Cancer Institute, took time off of his own job and put his own job on the line to fly to Texas and testify on Brzezinski's behalf in court, saying he's never seen brain cancer cures like this in his life. It doesn't happen. This is miraculous, et cetera. So he had everything going for him. Then on a federal level, they are trying to, of course, accuse him for shipping the medicine across state lines. And they have one grand jury after another after another, all ending in no indictment, and to the point where congressional hearings were called, patients were yelling and screaming in Congress. Mm-hmm. And then they, of course, finally got an indictment, and, of course, he was freed by two sets of jurors that he was, completely, done. He broke no laws. He was doing nothing wrong. And they even tried to hide from the jury whether or not the treatment even worked. So they tried everything.
I want to read this quote that you have on your title page. It constitutes nothing less than one of the worst abuses of the criminal justice system I've ever witnessed. Congressman Richard Burr, Republican, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's now a senator in North Carolina.
Yeah, so that's our own congressional inquiry. Branch, the branch that's supposed to keep some balance of power in place.
Right. And it makes you realize how powerful the industry is, because even if the majority of Washington knows this treatment exists and knows it's real, including the White House, by the way, David Axelrod, Obama's senior advisor, has seen this film. He saw it back in November. And he's good friends with the person who's in charge of raising Brzezinski's money for his phase three clinical trials. That's been very challenging. So he met.
How much money are we talking about? Just to
give
people an idea.
We're talking about $150 million.
I think that's important for people to understand.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has ever been able to do this as a private person.
No, it hasn't been done.
I don't think they have. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that's a very important point. Who has $150 million lying around?
Well, you think that, there's the Gates Foundation, there's all Bloomberg, there's all kinds of people that can write a check tomorrow, or at least get the people together to do so, considering it would be just one big charitable tax write-off anyway.
Right.
But, he's had numerous people step up to the plate, and want to do it, and then for some unknown reason, they just disappear. It just dissolves, and they don't really have much of an explanation as to why they've changed their mind. And a good example of this is Jeff Kindler, the CEO of Pfizer, called up Brzezinski last December, said, "I'm aware that you've been given permission to start phase 3 trials. Let's talk soon about partnering with you and making and selling the drug once it's approved." Everyone was very excited. Maybe the tide's turning. And, of course, he never called back or returned any phone calls. clearly. So the way I see it is, once this thing is approved, if it is at all, which I'm hopeful that it can be, the only way it's going to be approved is if, like my film hopefully will help, is if the awareness has been made. If people are aware of what of the status of this, and to get the majority of the public understanding this, and get the majority of the public standing up, the politicians are going to have no choice. It's going to just like what happened to him in the 90s when the politicians stood up to try to keep him out of prison, and the patients stood up saying, you know, yelling and screaming, saying, he's cured my cancer, cured my child's cancer. Why are you trying to take the treatment away? And that kind of needs to happen again. And I'm hoping the film will be helpful. But the way I see it is, if it's released to the market, and people think that they're just out there to, I don't know, just hide the cure for cancer, it's not so simple. If you have a patented drug like this released to the market, even if he did partner with Pfizer and it's released to the market, that entity has a 7-year exclusive license to make and sell it so before it becomes generic. So what is going to happen to Bristol-Myers Squibb and Amgen and Johnson & Johnson and all of the other guys when this thing hits the market and one entity has an exclusive license to make and sell what is essentially the biggest cancer breakthrough that has gone through the system correctly and hit the market, and nobody else can have it but that entity? And who's going to go get chemo for lung cancer when he's got, you know what I mean? It's going to be devastating financially.
And it's important to emphasize, this is a non-toxic treatment.
Right.
Non-toxic, and probably not that expensive compared to, you know, other treatments.
Absolutely not as expensive compared to other treatments, because usually if it does work, you're going to know it's going to work within the first 30 days or so, because it doesn't work for everyone, because it affects the genes, and it needs more time to develop it to cover a wider array of patients.
Research and development.
Right. And
that's where the big money needs to come in. I mean,
these
big pharmaceutical companies need to get their people and get labs going to because he's done a lot of work with changing it since he discovered it, or especially for different cancers. So,
because he doesn't
extract
it.
It's an ongoing process, like anything.
Absolutely. He doesn't extract it. It's one thing that people get confused by is he does not extract it from blood and urine anymore. He does a patent on synthesizing them from scratch. So basically it allows your body to help create these peptides again by basically giving you the right chemicals to make your body do so, essentially. That's what's going on. So, yeah, I mean, you'd think. And I just found out, this is really exciting, a former NIH employee, this is just in the last 48 hours it's developed, a former National Institute, whoops, sorry, there's a wind blowing through my home and a door slammed, who worked on Brzezinski's a treatment and studied it, and he was hired to study it, a government employee, he filed all sorts of positive reports for it. And and eventually, if you notice in the film, if you remember in the film, the NCI trials that were botched and rigged to fail, he was close to those. He was also working with Dr. Devorth Summies in her lab, one of the persons who worked with the government to help file duplicate patents of his substance, which is a whole other realm. But I'm hoping to talk to him really soon, and maybe he'll step forward and go on camera. But I can't remember my point of bringing him into the fray. But it's just a good example of showing how he left the NIH because of this exact type of corruption. And he moved back to China, where he's from. He's studying different things there. But it's interesting. One of Brzezinski's former colleagues, apparently, is in China now. And he pulled out an extract from the urine originally, and it completed phase 3 trials in China. So it's essentially the same treatment being done over there, but based only on the blood and urine, which is interesting as well. Anyway, so I guess I'll stop there for rambling.
No. Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about what happened with the specifically what happened when the National Cancer Institute did those trials supposedly to prove that his stuff didn't work.
Yeah, in In 1991, the National Cancer Institute sent down, I guess, a half a dozen or so scientists. They're like top cancer specialists, including Dr. Nicholas Petronas, who I mentioned earlier, who testified on Brzezinski's defense in court. They went in there, they studied his files, studied his records, studied the methods, met the patients, and verified for themselves it was indeed working. He was curing glioblastoma, you know, really deadly brain cancers.
Yeah, things and, that people don't have much time when they get them.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I show in the film all the internal documentation that they had that was internally passed around in documenting all of this, including the actual records they reviewed, all of it. So right after that happened, it's such an overlapping kind of a collusion. I'll try to make it as simple as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Right before this happened, he did have some interest, before 1991, before the visit, he did have some interest from the pharmaceutical industry. And there was a Japanese company and an Italian company both wanting to move forward with it and partner with him. But in their own documentation, they said, sorry, we have to pull out of this. It's clear the FDA is not going to cooperate with us. Why go forward? It's just going to be a waste of our time and money.
Right.
However, Brzezinski treated the CEO's sister-in-law of cancer and of a company called Elan Pharmaceutical. And so everything seemed like it was going great. And Brzezinski had assigned one of his scientists to Elan to work with them. So this is right before 91. And I'll give the big punchline at the end of this little
bit.
So just keep that in mind, you know, the audience remember what I said about Elan and one of his scientists. The National Cancer Institute went in, they verified that it worked. Then they said, okay, this is grounds to begin government-sponsored clinical trials. Let's do it. It makes sense to us, and we're going to sponsor it, and we're going to run it, and it'll, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then, so what happens? Elan realizes that one of the substances in one of his medicines is a pretty common substance, and Brzezinski never patented it. He was advised he shouldn't even bother trying to because it was just very common. This substance was inert on its own. It was crucial to be used with another proprietary substance that he had. So Elan just looked at this one substance and said, you don't have a patent on that. We're backing out. And then and by this time, they had become really close to his own scientist that I mentioned in developing this drug. So the scientist disappears and runs off with Elan and partners with the National Cancer Institute. They decide to test the single substance. So what happens is they push Brzezinski's initial trials they agreed upon. They push that into the back burner and just basically put it on hold and to go forward without Brzezinski testing this individual substance. Brzezinski showed them the data and warned them, saying, look, this substance doesn't work. Like, I proved it 12 years ago.
Right.
It doesn't work. And they spent some $20 million and 4 years of research testing it, and they'd even tested it on people. These poor people were hopeful that this treatment would help them, and they got nowhere. And so, of course, as the test failed, they finally go, okay, we'll do your clinical trials. And right out of the gate, they wanted to change his protocol, change the schedules, and change based on 20 years of his experience, treating people, getting it as perfect as he could at the time. They come in wanting to change it all. So he said, no, I'm not letting you change it. I'm not going to even give you my medicine until you agree to, you know, do it the way I've been doing it. So they finally agree on paper, and he sends off his medicine, and of course they change the whole thing. Anyway, without him. So he finds out about it, and it's on the news even, you know, mainstream news. They interview the doctors, and of course they're saying that it's Brzezinski's fault. He's not cooperating with us, and Brzezinski's saying, no, they're not cooperating with me. They signed off on the protocols, and they're intentionally breaking them, and this is very dangerous. It's very bad for the patients, obviously.
Yeah.
So it got even worse. And I show in the film all the back and forth letters between the National Cancer Institute and particularly Dr. Michael Friedman, who's a huge cancer researcher, and he's now the CEO of the City of Hope Cancer Hospital in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so all is back and forth between Brzezinski and Michael Friedman. And it got to the point where Friedman just shuts Brzezinski out of the trials altogether. So he has no idea what's going on. He threatens legal action to shut the trials down and basically did eventually force them to stop the trials because he realized they're letting in patients that did not fit the criteria and they're changing the dosage levels and everything else. And what's so amazing is that it just goes to show how arrogant these guys are and the thinking that they're unbeatable and they're untouchable. It was the NCI stated and gave it in a public press release that since the trials were halted prematurely, they were basically worthless and they're scientifically invalid. There's no way to justify saying here or there what antineoplasmids are capable of doing. So then after he defeats the state government, defeats the federal government, and calls them out on their own, carelessness and their own maliciousness, frankly, on their clinical trials. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, the NCI decides to simply vindictively publish these in the peer-reviewed literature, these exact trials that they said 4 years earlier were invalid. And they not only do they do it, and they say that the treatment doesn't work and all patients died, they were careless enough to include in the data, in the report, the blood levels of the antineoplastone levels in all the patients.
Which weren't high enough.
And they were, they were literally diluting the medicine. And in his strongest medicine, antineoplastone A10, it was like 170 times lower than the blood levels found in the system. And on top of that, Brzezinski had been warned by other patients' relatives that they're diluting the medicine. We're watching it happen. But there was no way to prove that. It's just one person saying that. Mm-hmm. But here's the proof. It's their own clinical trial data, their own blood level data, and showing how they did it. And on top of that, what also alerted Brzezinski was all of the patients were suffering from really bad fluid retention, having all this excess fluid in their system. And it didn't really make any sense because one of the only side effects of Brzezinski's treatment, which is basically the only one, he has to use sodium to deliver the medicine into the system. This is what he chose as sort of like a carrier. And because of that, it creates massive dehydration in the system. And some of the patients I interviewed talked about having to drink like 3 gallons a day, even young children, 3 gallons a day of water. And like they said, sometimes they couldn't make it to the bathroom fast enough to urinate because there was so much water going into them. Mm-hmm. So everything contradicted everything. Like it causes dehydration, not fluid retention. It was just amazing. So anyway, so that's essentially what happened there. And you only have to sort of come to the conclusion on your own conclusion. Why did they do it? Why did they rig it? Did they want to show the world that it didn't work?
I don't think it was because they're stupid. I think it's intentional.
Right.
I think it's obvious it's intentional because if they were just being stupid, it wouldn't have been published later.
Right, that's correct.
No, they were stupid because the evidence was in the publication, and they obviously overlooked that. But, I think it's just pure and simple that the government agencies from the FDA on, including all of the agencies that are involved here, basically are controlled by Big Pharma.
That's correct. I mean, Big Pharma has completely usurped the Drug Evaluation Department and most of the government agencies, because they have to. In order to survive in this system, you have no choice. You have to, because they are the gatekeepers, and if you want to keep your stock going up, you have to overrun them. And it's just economics 101. It happens every day. No different than how the oil companies have, especially back in the Bush years, they were just running rampant, doing whatever the heck they wanted to do, including going into Iraq and killing a million people to get more oil.
Did you see this week's Time magazine?
I have not.
It's you'll want to get a copy. The cover, well, not the cover story, but one of the stories inside is the FDA on drugs.
That's great.
It really is. But I wrote a book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, and as you may have known, 8 FDA research scientists blew the whistle on the FDA. I think it was in the New York Times, saying that science was ignored and politics followed in these following things, and of course breast implants were part of it. When they reapproved silicone breast implants in 2006, on the FDA's website was a study partially paid for by the FDA that ruptured silicone implants are associated with high levels of fibromyalgia, which is a chemical toxicity. So
You're talking about the letter that 9 scientists wrote to Obama's
nine transition. Scientists.
I have that letter, actually, the actual letter. Yep, it's on my website.
I was really happy that they turned the FDA in because I didn't want to have to.
Right.
In my book, I just quoted them. It was real easy.
Right. I mean,
I didn't have to go after the FDA. It was their own people did it.
Exactly. And it goes to show, again, how powerful they are, because this letter was given to our own president's transition team leader. And in the first sentence, it said, "It is fundamentally broken, failing to fulfill its mission." And nothing has been done to address this. And you have to infer that the only reason that is bigger than the White House. This is bigger than what the president
I think it's bigger than our nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is worldwide, and I think that until I call them the powers that be, and we don't know exactly how they're organized, but there are some theories.
Mm-hmm.
Until the powers that be loosen their stranglehold on institutions, and I guess the people can actually get some justice in the justice system and intelligent laws in the legislative area and intelligent decisions in the executive branch, you know, I think it's business as usual.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, why is a politician given permission to make decisions about science? You know,
exactly.
They're not scientists, so why are they interfering with it? So it's the whole system is completely broken. It's just really sad.
Yeah.
I want to, before we get too far, I want to sort of give like the big icing on the cake earlier about the NCI trials and everything.
Right.
So if you remember, you know, Alon, one of his scientists, botched trials, published.
Mm-hmm.
He defeated everybody. So what was going on? And I didn't know this until, and most of all of this I didn't really know until I met Brzezinski and I really learned all of it. I just wanted to talk about medicine, talk about some of his struggles. I didn't realize how deep it went. So what was happening was, when I mentioned earlier, in 1991, it was in October 1991 when the NCI visited this clinic, what he didn't know then, but he found out later, and I have in the film, is 17 days after they left his clinic, they filed their first patent, a duplicate patent, using one of his Brzezinski's own scientists on one of his medicines. And they filed 11 of them.
Yep.
And they kept filing them. And again, it was assigned to the United States Department of Health and Human Services, with the inventor being one of Brzezinski's own scientists. And in the patents is Elan Pharmaceuticals. They were included. So it was a clear indication that they were trying to steal it. So the same government agency that was trying to throw him in prison, trying to tell the world that it doesn't work, and rigging his trials, they were also going behind his back, patenting the very same medicine that was all this was involved in. So.
Yep.
And what's interesting is once the 11th patent was filed, and we talk about, everybody knows about the revolving door between the government agencies and pharma especially, and when you have drug evaluation people from pharmaceutical industry working for the FDA, that's a big problem. So in this case, I have no proof of him and his involvement really, but it's just an interesting coincidence. But Michael Friedman, the same man who led the NCI trials that were rigged and botched and the medicine was diluted and everything, he was like, this guy's like friends with Bill Clinton. He was appointed by Clinton. He's a big, big player in the cancer world. He leaves his position at the NCI and becomes Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the Food and Drug Administration, working directly under the commissioner. And only a couple of months after he moves is when the FDA magically gets their first indictment on him. And this is after the patents were filed. And it's just fascinating to see the timeline sort of come together. It's just very interesting. And so, it just shows how real the treatment is, and it shows you how powerful and how much of a threat it is to the establishment if this thing got out. So
let's go back and give our audience a little bit of an idea of how much Big Pharma makes on cancer treatments. Do you have that an estimate of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially
one drug or
for instance, Avastin. It's a gene-targeted drug, just like Brzezinski's, except it's not nearly as effective, and it also has a lot of very damaging side effects. To be on that drug, and only that drug, is about $100,000 a year that they make on that individual patient, on that taking that individual drug. And, of course, the insurance companies will cover that. That's great. So then you compare that to, say, someone, like one patient I interviewed that had colon cancer. He was cured in 4.5, cancer-free in 4.5 months, and then, of course, the cure rate, you have to be cured based on 5-year survival. You know, he spent $40,000 to be cured of cancer in 4.5 months. Compare that, if he was taking, say, Avastin, if they felt like he should be on that, he, first of all, wouldn't have been cured. He would have just been on it for years until he died. So cancer treatment is a cash cow, and especially when you think about things like radiation treatment for inoperable brain tumors like glioblastoma, you're looking at like a $60,000+ medical bill for a course of radiation that the insurance company pays, and they know the patient's going to die because they have no scientific data to support that anyone has ever lived through that type of cancer. It's very fascinating. And then when the same exact cancer has been treated by Brzezinski. And there is data, the own government's data, showing that the stats, showing how his treatment is effective with glioblastoma versus chemo and radiation. It's the difference is night and day. So yeah, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry itself is the second most profitable industry pretty much on the globe. And it was.
Is that after the chemical industry?
It's after oil. Yeah.
Oil, okay.
And there was a time in the 90s where it was more profitable than oil. And then actually after 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq and the oil prices jumped is when oil surpassed the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Marcia Angel, the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, she has a great book. I think it's called The Truth About Drug Companies, I believe. And she's done all this research on how much money they spend, where the money's allocated. What's fascinating is that I don't remember I think it's like 87. I'm not going to get the numbers exactly right, but I think it was like 87 billion collectively is what the pharmaceutical industry spends every year on everything, research and development, advertising, and everything. And she found out that basically 35 billion of this is unaccounted for. They're not able to account for it. And it's also interesting is that people think the pharmaceutical industry spends all this money on research and development. They do, of course, but it's the smallest portion of what they spend money on. Mm-hmm. It's like $17 billion. And it's like, while advertising is like $35. But this other mysterious $35, Dr. Angel has come up with a theory that that's where your ghostwriting money and all that stuff comes in. Because when they hire doctors to write articles that put in peer-reviewed literature, like what happened with Vioxx, they hired a bunch of doctors to create fake data, imaginary patients, says Vioxx works. They get paid off really well. They get published in peer-reviewed journals, the gospel that it's fine. And when in reality, they knew it was a dangerous, terrible drug, and everybody was going to profit off of it. And even if they get sued, which they did, they still come out ahead financially. It doesn't matter. you can have a class action lawsuit for some $4 billion, and pharma still makes a profit. It doesn't matter most of the time.
Right.
So it's interesting. It's a very, very corrupt, powerful entity that it makes a fortune. And, they've just got the doctors in the palm of their hands as well. Some of these oncologists, they won't go on camera, but they're like, a board certified oncologist can make $250,000 a year, but he'll make another additional million in chemotherapy commission. They've got a stranglehold.
They don't want to change either for something that isn't profitable to them.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for somebody to give all that up, that give that lifestyle up.
So what do you foresee? We talked a little bit about it earlier that, people have to start speaking up, especially through their representatives in Congress. But how do we make our way out of this mess?
I think the step one is people have to know about it. And I think there's a couple of levels of way to go about it. I think the first is try to get some celebrity involvement because they have so much power to get the ear of people. Michael Douglas was recently diagnosed with throat cancer, and we've been trying to get a copy to him, and we're going through his agency and another documentary filmmaker that had him as his narrator. I'm going through him as well, try to get him a copy. All we need is one Michael Douglas to go to Brzezinski, be cured, go back on Letterman, and tell the world. It's going to cause a lot of it's going to cause huge waves. And also, I mean, I would not be surprised at all if once people knew about it and they realize, say some glioblastoma patients understand that they're going to die and the only chance they have, if it's inoperable, and the only chance they have is Brzezinski, that you're going to start seeing some protests. You're going to start seeing people, standing up and saying, no, I refuse all treatment unless you give me this, and I'm going to start making a lot of noise about this, I don't know. I mean, I just want to like to see things like that begin to happen. Unfortunately, we have to be at the mercy of the politicians, and the only way they're going to listen is if they have a majority, and we threaten them with something they can lose unless they lean this direction. That's the only way I can see it. Also, what's exciting is that Japan, fortunately, has been very supportive of anti-neoplastons. They have just completed their first phase 3 trial for colon cancer. Phase 3 is the final phase before approval. And, of course, the results were for 2-3 times plus the survival rate of mainstream treatment on colon cancer. And unlike the United States, the Japanese government and the Japanese medical establishment is very supportive. They're not interfering or trying to suppress it. Japan just has a little bit more freedom. They give more freedom to physicians. Even the Gerson therapy is being used over there in a mainstream level. So anyway, that's exciting. So what that means is, it's probably going to be approved in Japan before here. So they're going to sort of be the trailblazers, set the precedent. We're going to have people flying to Japan to be treated, you know, legally. And then maybe that will help push the move. But again, it's so hard to imagine allowing one company to have the rights to make and sell it. It's going to just destroy the rest of the industry. You would think that CEOs of Pfizer and so on would be smart enough to realize that they could, if this truly is a capitalist system, and that's what, and it's about the competition, they have an opportunity to completely destroy their competitors by
Let me tell you something. Unless they don't have a family, unless they have incredible security, they will be encouraged not to make that decision.
That's right. And
that's the level of the threat that will be made.
Absolutely, and that's, I think that's why Pfizer backed out after their phone call
death threats,
last December.
I'm sure, or in, you know, implied threats.
You know, I talked to a former lobbyist for Roche Pharmaceutical who's retired this last week, and his son had seen the film, and he emailed me and said, "My dad's a retired Roche lobbyist, and he'd love, you know, we got to talk to him." Fine, and I talked to him on the phone, and I asked him, I said, "So, based on the 7-year exclusive license I mentioned, and everything else." And I said, "Do you know, why do you think it is that no pharmaceutical company will step up?" Because I really don't know how to answer that question. You'd think they would. And he said, and it's so funny because these people are so close to it, they just can't believe it's possible. It's all, it's going back to the religious belief kind of dogmatic. He's like, because he just says, there's no way that the pharma itself would ever stop something like this. It's a very competitive world, and they, if this is real, they're going to jump on it, and they would have jumped on it a long time ago, blah, 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 blah. He believes it's real. He saw the film, but it's very interesting. So I said to him, so, well, you know, pharma, from what I understand, is sort of like a big entity, kind of like how the Milk Council is for the milk industry. You know, you have the Got Milk campaign. They sort of represent the industry. And that's what pharma sort of is. They have their own board of directors, from what I understand, and that's what they do. They're sort of, they represent the whole industry. So it would only make sense to me that maybe they're the ones stopping their own industry from letting this go forward. You know what I mean? But again, I have no proof of that, but it would make sense. I would assume that they would have to sort of consult with them on some level and get sort of permission, but I don't have any proof of that. But
and I really believe that there is something at a higher level stopping it as well. I think it's something that is not interested in massive response to anything with cancer.
Right.
So we've got that. I mean, I think there are agendas beyond pharma that control pharma.
Could be. Absolutely. And it's so interesting. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it's so interesting that, like you, like as you know, it's not the first time this has happened. It's not an isolated incident.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, and
it's,
you know, like,
worldwide. It's literally worldwide. It is not just in the U.S. either.
Absolutely. Yeah, what got me interested in this too, I talked about Ralph Moss, is I thought it was so interesting that Laetril, you know, while it was never really a cure. But, you know, the NCI tested it. Everybody tested it. And in vitro and in animals, it was a virtually 90% preventative of cancer. And then also a 90% stoppage of all metastasis. So it worked really well on the cellular level. But again, it was a food. It came from certain foods, couldn't patent it. And Sloan Kettering's own leaders, according to Ralph and his data, went to the NCI and went to the FDA in two separate years begging and pleading to allow the Laetril to be tested on humans. And they turned them down both times. So the leaders were put in a position where they were forced to lie about it. So they knew they were lying. And I watched Daniel Ellsberg's a documentary about him, The Most Dangerous Man in the Room, where, you know, back in the day, he worked for the Pentagon, and he released all the internal documents and just blew the whistle on the lies of the Vietnam War. There's one line in that film, I think he talked about McNamara, where he said, and he showed the clip of this guy lying, one of our heads of Washington, and they said, I hope I'm never in a position of power where I am forced to lie like that. and again, that's exactly what happened to Sloan Kettering. That's exactly what's happening with Brzezinski, is these people are not allowed to tell you the truth when it comes to things like this. So another interesting thing is, like, you know, if you think about it, every aspect of technology whether it be computers or automobiles or what have you, it's just skyrocketed. And cancer treatment has been stuck in the same position it's been in since the 40s. It's just, it's fascinating. It's a, I don't know. Anyway, just another observation.
Well, given that one in two men will get cancer and one in three women will get cancer, and that statistic is actually increasing. And if you talk about brain tumors, I predict that we'll have a whole rash of brain tumors from our electromagnetic situations and how that affects neuroepithelial malignancies. I interviewed Dr. Carlo on this radio show. He did $20 million of research for the cellular phone industry, and when he found that cellular telephones really do cause malignancies of the brain, including neuroblastomas and other, not neuroblastomas, but epithelial malignancies, as well as benign tumors. You know, he had to flee for, they burned down his house and he had to flee.
Are you serious? He burned down his house? Oh my goodness.
That's what I was told.
Brzezinski,
by people
refuses,
close to him.
Brzezinski refuses to own a cell phone. Read that kind of research, so that's also interesting.
Well, there's other reasons for that too. Directed energy can be brought through a cell phone,
right?
So, but I think I just admire the man's courage and his fortitude and stamina, because this has got to be mentally challenging. You know, when you've got all these critically ill patients and you're working against the clock to help them, and then you keep being bothered by everybody and people trying to steal your discoveries, and it's just, it's incredible. He must be an incredibly strong individual.
He is, and again, it goes back to he knows he's right, and he knows that it's worth the fight. It's worth risking prison time to stand up for what you realize is real and what's better for the sake of humanity, frankly. And again, going back to realizing how every scientist in history has been met with massive resistance when it comes to changing what is considered the standard.
Right.
And he just knows it. And, you know, a good example, like I have in the film, is Ignaz Semmelweis, an Hungarian doctor who was the first guy to realize that maybe it's a good idea as a physician to wash your hands before delivering a baby or, you know, undergoing any sort of surgical procedure at all, even though delivering a baby is not really surgery unless it's cesarean. But, and, you know, he was kicked out of the profession for this observation of just, hey, guys, wash your hands first, you know. And so
the doctors were coming in from the autopsy labs, too.
That's correct.
That was a very bad thing.
Yeah, they were.
So they were actually bringing a lot of germs in.
Yep, they're performing autopsies, in some cases with people that have peripheral fever, and peripheral fever was a really major cause of death in women after childbirth. And so they had no gloves on, and they'd go right out of the basement of the autopsy room, right upstairs with unwashed hands, bare hands, and deliver kids, and the parents would die. And, of course, one of his colleagues cut his finger accidentally during an autopsy, came down with a symptoms of peripheral fever, died, and that's why he said, oh, my gosh, maybe we're transferring the disease. Wash your hands.
Something so simple.
And what's important for people to realize is that was just the belief system. It had nothing to do with money.
Right.
There's no thing to profit off of hand washing.
No.
You know? So it wasn't like a conspiracy for the, you know, the rubber glove makers. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly.
Right. So it's massive. It's a massive hurdle because we have all these factors against you.
Well, how do people get a hold of the DVD? Can you give your contact information?
Sure. Brzezinski Movie, brzezinskimovie.com. There's the trailers. There's an order form for DVD. It's also on Amazon. I'll spell it. It's brzezinskimovie.com. And I've been moving a lot of DVDs. There's a couple of major celebrities that are going to step up and endorse it. I don't want to say who they are, but that's one of them. One of the endorsements is going to happen next week. It should be really interesting. Yeah, and they're going to do it on their Twitter account with nearly 2 million people following this person. So it's really going to be exciting.
Oh, super!
And then here's something else to remember before we go. I'm not going to tell you which one because I'm going to give them that much respect, but one of the major networks is going to have an hour special with Brzezinski and Dr. Gonzalez included. I'm included. They've been to my screenings. They have the film. They've interviewed me on camera. They have all the documents that I have in that film. However, I don't believe they're going to do a very good job. I don't believe they're going to tell the truth. And in fact, one of them even told me, I want to do the right thing, but I'm not sure if my bosses will allow me to do so.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So
you need to get something like the Discovery Channel or, you know, Discovery Health or Link TV is good. You need to do something on one of the cable channels that isn't influenced by the powers that be.
Well, you're not going to believe this, but and I can't believe it myself, but one of these major networks, a major network, it's cable, but it's a subsidiary of one of the major networks. They've already, I met with them, had a 2-hour meeting with all their documentary heads, and they said they're willing to air the film if I have to make it shorter, which is fine, and I have to include some big fish. So I managed to get one guy from the NIH. I'm going to meet with him in D.C. in late September, and another guy who also works from the NIH. I'm going to try to get him in, and I'm trying to get a handful of more board-certified oncologists in the film. And they swear that if I can get that in, it'll make it more airtight, at least in their opinion, and they'll consider airing it. And the same is happening in England, U.K., rep has found a network that will do it under the exact same conditions. So I'm going to have to spend my own money and time and redo the film just for the sake of television. And so that's exciting. And again, when I put the film together, I wanted to preach not to the choir. I wanted to let both the layman and the scientist and the cancer specialist where they can understand it. And I used their own rules to show them. I don't show case histories or anecdotal stories. I show the very same scientific data based on the scientific method, the supposed method that they're taught to respect, and that's what how I present the information. And it's been really effective. And I think that's why major networks have been agreeing to maybe consider it, because it's hard to argue with it. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like it's right there, and again, I'm playing by their rules.
Hard science.
Yeah. Exactly. So.
Yeah. Well, I really wish you luck with this. I think it's an incredibly important, not just the information to get out, but this thing that we need to break, which is the resistance to cancer or any other disease treatments that are effective being suppressed, which I believe is done actively, and especially in cancer, but is also being done in other fields as well. And I think we need to, you know, like you say, step up and get the legislatures involved, get the first thing is education of the people who can make a difference, maybe some people who aren't afraid to donate money toward clinical trials on these substances and just get the awareness up. And it's just amazing to me that this stuff has been suppressed so long. I mean, I think it really makes you wonder what is actually going on at the highest levels in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, give your website one more time if you would spell it again for us.
Sure. Burzynski, movie, burzynskimovie.com. And I have a lot of clips on YouTube now where probably 30% of the film is chopped up on YouTube in various clips as well. So
I've recommended a lot of people go look at your YouTube stuff. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Eric McCullough, who is the, the producer and director of Burzynski, the movie, and we'll be having some exciting new things, hopefully, on TV, as well as has a bunch of stuff on YouTube. Please take a look at all of that, as well as take a look at his DVD. Next week, we will be interviewing Harold Koenig on chronic pain, and then Paul Rademacher, who is the head of the Monroe Institute, will be joining us again on the 18th, and we will be interviewing the author of Fatty Liver on the 25th. Our Noetic Science meeting on Thursday, September 16th at 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. Dr. Brad Gould will be discussing electromagnetic fields, including the cell phone, computer, Wi-Fi, all of these, and what effect they have on your body, electromagnetic pollution. Again, thank you very much for joining us. This has been Temple of Health Radio Show.
headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong, it was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677.